Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for the Tech Guy podcast is provided by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET for DSL Extreme.
Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on Saturday, August 18th, 2007, on the Premier Radio Networks. This is show 379. Well, a very good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, and it's time to talk high tech. I am so happy. I love coming in here on the weekends and spending some time with you talking about this stuff that's changing our lives, changing the world. It's the toy store. Yeah, I mean, it's cool, shiny gadgets and fun computers, but it's also important. It's fun. It's serious at the same time. I like that. It's a nice combination. I mean, here we are in a century that is defined by its technology. Last century, it was television, radio, jet airplanes that changed really the face of the planet. Nuclear bombs. This century, it's information technology. It's the internet, computers, cell phones. And believe it or not, I think digital content creation devices like camcorders and digital cameras, digital recording, I think those are as important as cell phones, computers, and the internet. And when you combine them, what power to record your own music? Tomorrow I'm going to play my son. He's 13. But he spent the week at a band camp with four guys he'd never met before. They created a band, rehearsed for 4 days, recorded a CD on the fifth day. Now imagine that. Recorded a CD. So I'll play a little song from it because I'm a proud pop. But also I just think it's an example of what you can do. You couldn't record us 10 years ago. You're not going to give a $1 million studio to five 13-year-olds and say, here, record your CD, kid. Let's see what you got. But today, the technology is so affordable. I think they did it on a laptop. I'll talk a little bit later about a new camcorder that's just come out from Panasonic that brings high-def video, really good quality high-def video now, into the mainstream. I ordered the new one, which won't be out till September 15th, and I'll give you a review at that time. It's a solid-state camcorder, and I think this is, if you have a computer, for a long time I was, until like maybe last week, I said, if you're going to get a camcorder, don't get one that records to DVD unless you don't have a computer, and don't get one that records Flash, unless you're willing to give up some quality. Well, that's about to change, thanks to a Panasonic. Now, I've talked before about the X-Acti, the HD2, which I think is a great little hand camcorder, but not a very high quality hand camcorder. Well, now there is a new Flash camcorder from Panasonic that is kind of mind-blowing. Records to SD cards. And now they're big enough. You know, 4 gigabytes gives you an hour. That should tell you something if you're paying attention to this, by the way. 4 gigabytes an hour means that's a pretty high quality. These use a new video format called AVC HD. Sony's got them. Canon's got them. Panasonic's got them. Panasonic for $1,000, this is what's interesting to me, for $1,000, which is kind of what, you know, all along we've expected to pay for a decent camcorder. That's kind of the price point, right? For $1,000, 3 CCDs, which means it's very, very high quality, records 1080p to Flash, has HDMI out for $1,000. I'm going to review this in a couple of weeks. But to me, this looks like the beginning of the ability for people to really make their own movies with high-definition camcorders. I mean, this is for very affordable prices. Apple was showing this off at their event. This is where it caught my attention. They were all excited about this new AVC HD format. 1920 by 1080 recording. H.264 has a Leica lens, three CCDs, up to an hour on a 4 gigabyte card. I mean, we're talking high quality here. And my friend Annie Inatko writes for the Chicago Sun-Times, sent me some still images pulled from this camera, and I was blown away. I mean, the quality is very, very good. So I'll get your report on that. That's what's changing. That's what's exciting. Big story this week was Skype was out for about 2 days. Now, maybe that didn't get up on your radar, but anybody who uses Skype was a little freaked out. And admittedly, there are many other choices. There are other ways you can go. Skype is that program that you use on your computer, Mac, Windows, Linux, to call other computers for free anywhere in the world. The quality is amazing. It's what I use for all my podcasts. Many of the contributors you hear on the show, people like Scott Wilkinson, who's coming up in about half an hour to talk about home theater, use Skype. We'll talk on Skype, and it sounds like they're in studio. I mean, it's very high quality. Skype also has the ability to call phones and to be used with regular phones. So it's a true full voice over the internet. Out for two days. Whew, not good. And it's not some little tiny company here either. This is owned by eBay. I mean, they got some bucks behind them. Something went wrong with the software configuration. They weren't very specific about what went wrong, but the problem was they weren't able to get it working for 2 days. Went down Thursday, didn't really fully, I guess one day, but it went down Thursday morning, didn't fully come back till Friday afternoon, 1.5 days. And it's not a big deal. If you use Skype, it's a big deal. It was a big deal for me because I couldn't do any podcasts. But the bigger issue I think it raises is how fragile is our internet infrastructure? How reliant are we on it? And maybe we're cruising for a bruising. Here we are relying on this stuff for commerce, communication, for business. How many businesses run on the internet? Many businesses I know run on Skype. What was the cost of that? There's no redundancy for this stuff. There's no backup. If it goes out, you just sit there. It's like the power going out. Now, we've been relying on the power grid for a long time, and of course, government and industry have spent a lot of energy making it redundant and reliable, and despite all that, we still have major power outages, and look at the crisis that brings up. An internet outage is not as bad as a power outage. In fact, it's a subset, isn't it? If the power goes out, the internet goes out, too. But power outages are localized. An internet outage could be global. It could affect the whole world. I mean, the Skype outage affected the whole world. It's just an interesting issue. It raises some questions, at least in my mind. Are we prudent to be relying so heavily on something that is so fragile? And let me tell you, experts who follow this stuff, and we could talk to Steve Gibson, my security guy, about this perhaps. They'll tell you this stuff is very fragile. There's a bottleneck, a choke point on the internet that if this were to be damaged, if this choke point were to go out, and every hacker knows about this, by the way, so don't think it's a mystery. If this choke point were to be cut, the entire internet would stop working in 24 hours. And not a lot's being done about this. Some folks at Stanford have gotten together to talk about this and to say, well, if we were going to design the internet today, knowing what we know 30 years later, we didn't, for instance, when the internet was designed, there were no security issues. But knowing what we know 30 years later, how would we do things differently? What would the internet look like? And so there's some work in this direction. The problem is, how do you fix it without taking the internet down, without breaking everything existing? It's a problem I've talked about many times with Microsoft has. It's hard to fix Windows without breaking existing software. Imagine trying to fix the internet. It'd be kind of like pulling a tablecloth out from under a full dinner party and then getting a new tablecloth in without anybody noticing. It ain't easy. It may not be doable. We may be stuck with this fragile internet. So this choke point I was talking about are the DNS servers. There are 13 of them. They're the phone book of the internet. When you type in an internet address, www.techguylabs.com, for instance, Your browser doesn't know from techguylabs.com. What it does is it asks, first it asks the operating system, you know where Tech Guy Labs is? If the operating system doesn't know, then it queries the internet service provider. Do you know where the Tech Guy Labs is? It's kind of like a Dr. Seuss story. Do you know my mommy? Then if it doesn't, the internet service provider doesn't know, it queries higher up. Ultimately, it goes back to what are called the root servers, the domain root servers. 13 computers, that's all, worldwide. 13 computers that maintain the master phone book. So the first time you go to Tech Guy Labs, if your internet service provider doesn't know where it is, and it only caches this information for about a day, if it doesn't know, the first time you go there, first time anybody goes there, it goes all the way to the root server. Root server says, oh, yeah. Oh, I know where the Tech Guy Labs is. That's 64.32.9.9 or whatever it is. I actually don't know. You probably should know. Because if those domain root servers go down, 13 of them, and they could be easily attacked, either physically or by hackers with a denial of service attack. If they go down within 24 hours, all the caches on your computer, on your internet service provider's computers, on the upstream computers, all the way up to the root servers would go down. And pretty soon, you'd type techguylabs.com and get 404. Doesn't exist. You'd need to actually type the number to get to that site. And that's true of all the sites. It's a 75.126.60.236, just in case you memorize that, just so you can get to the Tech Guy Labs in future. Or Yahoo or Google. Problem is, you could get to Tech Guy Labs, you click a link, and it'd break again because the next site would be down. And the site after that, the whole internet would collapse. Email would collapse. Everything you do on the internet now would collapse. Skype would collapse. And we're all relying on these 13 computers. There's an example of the fragility of all this. A little scary. Hey, let's talk tech. 8888-ASK-LEO is my number. 8888-ASK-LEO. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo?
Yeah?
Can you take Kim and Buena Park, line 4?
Okay.
Thanks.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO is the number. 888-827-5536. Want to go to your calls. Coming up in just a bit, Scott Wilkinson, as I said, our home theater guru. But first, let's say hi to Kim in Buena Park, California. Hey, Kim.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Hey, I had a question for you about televisions. I want to buy an LCD.
Okay.
And I'm looking at one that's in 1080p, and then I hear about 1080i. Can you tell me what the difference is there?
You know, Scott has schooled me in this over and over again, and I'm going to try to say this correctly. Understand that if you're talking an LCD or a plasma, you're talking a digital screen that is the resolution of the screen. It's all of it's progressive. So I guess I have to define what progressive and interlaced is first. The old TV set that you had, you know, back in the 80s and 90s was interlaced. It couldn't draw the whole screen at once. It would have to draw the screen alternating lines. And this is actually going back to the earliest days of television when there literally wasn't enough bandwidth to draw a screen all at once. So it would draw the odd lines and then would draw the even lines. The electron gun would go up. That's interlaced. So by the time you had both those fields together, would do 60 fields a second, you'd have a full frame. So you'd get 30 frames a second composed of two half frames. And the eye resolved it. The eye was able to mush it all together and make it look like just as it is with a movie, make it look like a solid picture. But interlaced isn't as high quality as progressive as drawing all those lines in one pass. All computer monitors are progressive. All digital monitors are progressive. So when you talk about 1080i, that's interlaced, versus 1080p, progressive, you're not talking about the display. All displays are P. You're talking about what the input is. And some inputs, which would be maybe your cable TV, your satellite, your DVD player, some inputs are 1080p and some are 1080i. There's only a few 1080ps. High-def DVDs, for instance, Blu-ray and HD DVD, are capable of 1080p. But your cable company isn't. Your satellite company isn't. Even your broadcast high-def isn't. It's all 1080i or worse. It might be 720p. So it's the input. When you're talking about a TV that's capable of 1080i or 1080p, it's the input. Now, I'll tell you, when you look at a screen with a 1080p input, and you look at one that's 1080i and one that's 1080p, you're not going to see a lot of difference. In theory, the 1080p screen with a 1080p input, remember, it has to have a 1080p input for this to make any difference, will look better. But most experts I talk to say, well, it looks better if you're looking very closely and at specific things. But if you're just in general watching the TV, you're not going to notice a difference. If there's a big price differential between 1080i and 1080p, I'd say don't worry about it. Go with 1080i.
Okay, that's very helpful.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and that's very helpful. And I guess I can watch General Hospital on any old.
And General Hospital, who cares? Exactly. You know, because even if you're watching it in high def, are they doing it in high def now?
I don't know.
They may not be.
I'm not sure.
Some shows are. You know, Leno's high def. Obviously, sporting events, most of them are high def now. But if they're coming in right off broadcast cable or satellite, they're not 1080p anyway. So your TV wouldn't.
Are they headed that way, do you think?
Say again?
Are they headed that way, do you think?
No.
Go to the P or not really?
Probably not, because it's a lot of bandwidth.
Okay.
It takes up more bandwidth. And certainly the cable and the satellite folks are really struggling now with bandwidth as it is. They don't have a lot to spare. So it's highly unlikely they'll upgrade. Your over-the-air, I suppose, could, although they've already invested in these big physical plants. I don't think they're going to do it either. So really, the only thing you'll notice is HD DVDs or some other, you know, locally played back stuff. I think it's going to be DVDs for a while. And even then, I'll tell you, I've looked at them both. I don't see. I'll tell you, I'll put my money where my mouth is. The TV I bought is 1080i.
Okay,
so I wouldn't worry about it.
Can I ask you about a brand?
Of course. I love talking about brands.
Vizio.
Yeah, Vizio's an interesting story. Vizio actually does very good TVs. They're not a first-tier TV company. They're not a Sony, a Sharp, a Panasonic, a Pioneer. But so they're mostly sold in warehouse stores, but they make excellent quality TVs. And you know, the best selling plasma right now is a Vizio. The best selling LCD is a Vizio because the price is right. The 60-inch Vizio plasma is $3,000. That's a beautiful TV.
Yeah.
And the best selling, I think, the best selling HD TV last time I checked was their, I think it's a 47-inch LCD. So they do very good stuff. What you should look at when you're buying an HD TV, frankly, they all look great with high quality inputs. What you should look at is, how do they handle standard definition television? How do they? Because a lot of what you're going to watch still is going to be broadcast TV, standard definition. And if it looks bad, if you've been watching high def and say, boy, those look great, and then you go watch General Hospital and it looks awful, you're going to be very disappointed. So that's what actually I would look at is, what does it do with General Hospital? And the Vizios actually do a very good job.
Okay.
All right.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Kim. Thank you so much for calling. I know this is a thicket, this high def stuff. That's why Scott's going to come up. Scott actually is going to be talking about something completely different, but it should be fun. He's going to talk about audio. He's an audio expert as well as a video expert, and he's going to talk about the audio capabilities of these high-def discs, something people don't really pay much attention to. But in terms of, we're talking about video quality. Audio quality is very important. But in terms of video quality, I think almost any of these high-def TVs now, with a high-def input, they sure look good. I bought the Pioneer 5070. That's now a year old. But I like the Pioneer and Panasonic plasmas. I like a lot. I like the JVC for rear projection, the JVC DILA. I think they look really good. Those are Elcos rear projections. And in the, you have a lot of choices in the LCD. Even Westinghouse makes a good LCD. I have a Sharp myself. More of your calls coming up. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
I got a billboard, Leo.
GoToMeeting Web Conferencing, everyone can see your computer desktop on their computer screen. It's changing the way we do business. Try it free for 30 days. Go to GoToMeeting.com, click the orange Try It Free button, use my name, Leo, as the promo code. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, talking to Scott Wilkinson, the home theater guy. We're going to take some calls at 8888-ASK-LEO in a little bit, but I thought I'd get Scott on to talk about, just for a moment or two, about some aspect of home theater. Actually, today we're going to talk about something that you don't usually talk about. You're the video editor, at the Perfect
I am the video editor of the Perfect Vision magazine.
Yeah, but this is audio we're talking about.
You know, audio is such an important part of the home theater experience. If you don't have audio, you know, you're missing half the boat there.
Well, spoken like a true musician. But and I think, you know, even though you cover screens and video for the magazine, you have written many for a long time about audio. So you're
That's
really,
right.
And this is not something new for you.
No.
These are new formats, though, for most people. Things I've never heard of. I've heard of Dolby and I've heard of DTS, but this is for your high def DVDs.
That's right. For Blu-ray and HD DVD, DTS and Dolby, two different companies, both making audio codecs, coder decoders, have created new higher resolution versions of their technology. For DTS, it's called DTS HD. And Dolby is called, well, there's two of them. There's Dolby Digital Plus and Dolby True HD.
Now, I was talking to a friend at Dolby who said that, in fact, on Blu-ray, you can have completely uncompressed audio.
That's correct. And most Blu-ray titles, that's what they have, as well as normal, regular, good old Dolby Digital and DTS.
There's so much room on that disc. You can have multiple versions.
That's right. That's right. And the Blu-ray camp has more or less decided, up till now anyway, to use, in addition to those good old standard codecs, to use uncompressed PCM audio, which is the same as what's coming off of a CD.
And isn't that what I would want if I had the choice?
Yes, it is.
Compression hurts the quality.
Generally speaking, I would say that's true. But there are ways, even with Blu-ray's extreme capacity, and HD DVD too, for that matter, you got 50 gigabytes on a dual-layer Blu-ray and 30 gigabytes on a dual-layer HD DVD, uncompressed PCM audio still takes up a fair amount of space.
Right.
And the question really is, if you compress it, are you really going to hear the difference?
Well, and I can tell you right now, if it's compressed well on CD, you know, on MP3, for instance, I can't hear the difference.
That's exactly right. And MP3 is severe compression.
Now this is the compression, though, is independent of the surround technologies and everything, right? So you can,
in a sense, that's true.
You could have uncompressed DTS.
Well, you can. Oh, there are sort of two basic forms of compression. One is called lossy, and what that means is you're actually throwing away information. MP3 is a severely lossy compression scheme. Regular DTS is a lossy compression scheme. Dolby Digital is a lossy compression scheme. These new compression schemes that I'm talking about today, DTS HD and Dolby True HD, are what are called lossless compression.
Ah.
Which means that there's no information thrown away, but it's compressed a little bit, such as, say, a zip file on a computer.
But you lose no quality at all.
None whatsoever. And generally speaking, this lossless compression can save you about a factor of two.
Wow.
It can take the uncompressed PCM data and squeeze it into a space about half the size it would otherwise take.
So that's opposed to, let's say, the 10 times compression you get in a lossy compression
technology. Correct.
Okay. So it's five times bigger, but it sounds better.
But it sounds better.
Right.
Exactly. Now, there's a little bit of a sort of a, well, two things. One is, under DTS HD, there are two flavors. There's what's called DTS HD High Resolution, which is still lossy, but at a higher bit rate than regular DTS, so it should sound better.
Okay.
And then there's DTS HD Master Audio.
Oh, boy.
Which is lossless, truly lossless.
Okay.
It loses no audio information, which makes it equivalent to Dolby True HD in that sense.
Dolby does not have a lossy version of True HD. It's always lossless.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Their lossy version is called Dolby Digital and now Dolby Digital Plus, which is their newest version of that.
So is this both DTS HD and Dolby True HD available on both Blu-ray and HD DVD discs?
Yes, depending upon the studio and what they want to put on the disc.
So the studio will decide.
Correct. Now, there's another factor that people should be aware of. HD DVD players, by mandate, are required to be able to handle and decode all of these new codecs, and so all HD DVD players have them on board. Blu-ray players are only optional. For Blu-ray players, implementing these new codecs is optional.
So you may have this capability, but you may not ever be able to hear it.
That's right. It may be on the disc, but then you won't be able to hear it. There are no Blu-ray players that I know of, except one now, that that allow them to decode Dolby True HD or DTS HD. The new Panasonic DMP BD10A, the mouthful I know, can decode DTS HD high resolution, that better but still lossy codec, and Dolby True HD. It can decode those, but no other Blu-ray players I know of can. They can only do regular DTS, regular Dolby Digital, and uncompressed PCM, which is where Blu-ray titles are mostly going. Now, the question in my mind always is, if it's optional, how many manufacturers are going to actually implement it? I don't think very many, because it's optional. Yeah. Why should they spend the money if they don't have to?
Unless consumers are demanding it. But
unless consumers demand it. Correct.
Right.
That's exactly
so
right.
So it sounds like before I watch a high-def DVD these days, I should probably go into the audio settings and see what's available.
That's correct. That would be a very good thing to do. Yeah.
And if I had the choice, you'd recommend the DTS Master audio?
Well, any of the lossless codecs, okay, I would recommend, whether it's Dolby True HD or DTS HD Master Audio.
Okay.
That would be my first choice, simply because it's lossless.
Right.
There's no loss of information.
Even if you can't hear the difference, at least you know you're getting the best, right?
Exactly right. Exactly right.
Very cool.
On the other hand, if you're perfectly happy listening to MP3 on your iPod or whatever, then I doubt you're going to notice much difference, and it's going to be fine to select one of the other codecs that happen to be on that disc. But again, that's studio dependent. What did they choose to put on that disc? That's the choices you have.
And will the discs default to the highest quality, or do you have to actually go in there and choose it?
Then it depends on the disc. The disc itself, the way that it's authored, the way that it's created, will ultimately determine which one is selected by default.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know. I'm going to have to go home and look at all my discs now. I invite you to go home and look at the great Perfect Vision magazine. It's on newsstands everywhere, but you don't have to run out to the newsstand if you don't want to. You can also download a PDF of every issue when it comes out from avguide.com. It includes links to more information. I mean, it's a really great resource.
We try to put a lot more technical information behind the front, the opening page.
Right. So I've been keeping it as a, I've been keeping them as kind of a resource. They're very valuable that way. It's kind of my little library now.
Hey, cool.
Great magazine. AVGuide.com. We'll talk to you next week, Scott.
Sounds great, Leo.
Now let's get back to the phones. 888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. And let's see who I've got on the line here. I've got so many calls. I want to make sure I get to everybody. How about Peter in Buffalo, New York? Hey, Peter. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo, Vista put me over the edge.
Good or
when
bad?
I bought a Mac.
It was enough is enough, huh?
Yeah, and you know, the funny thing is, I'm the owner of a network services company, and we service Windows machines all over the place,
wow,
and we use a Mac.
Well, that's interesting. You know, I'm seeing more and more nerds move to Macs. There's some things about the Mac, like the underlying Unix, that are very appealing, frankly.
Well, you know what? I actually tried Ubuntu and a couple of distros of Linux and was really impressed with it. But, you know, with the getting a Mac, and I'm running Parallels for the programs I absolutely need.
Yeah, there you go.
But I'm trying to find more and more programs that can run natively on the machine, and I have to go through Parallels. And a big problem I have is I have a couple personal web pages I maintain, and I've been using FrontPage for years.
Oh, dear.
And it's pretty easy and straightforward, and it served me well. Now I'm looking for something on the Mac side to switch over to.
Yeah, the problem with FrontPage, at least until its most recent incarnation, was it was kind of a locked-in solution. It's much like Apple's own iWeb, where once you start using it, you're kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Because FrontPage does so many FrontPage-specific extensions that moving it to a generic web design tool is difficult.
Well, you know, I'm at the point with some of the pages. These are personal pages.
You might have to redesign. You might have to go.
Yeah,
you might have to take
out.
Like, if you have the FrontPage extension guestbook, you're not going to be able to use that anymore, but you could replace it.
Yeah, and I'm willing to go ahead and do that. And since Microsoft is going to stop supporting FrontPage, or they have already.
Yeah, they've abandoned
it. I want to get into something that is going to be easy to use and I can use for a while.
I'm getting a lot. You know, I said something on one of my podcasts this week or last week that got a lot of email. And I said that nobody uses Dreamweaver anymore. And I want to clarify that. Dreamweaver is certainly the tool of choice for doing static HTML pages. Very much like FrontPage, but it generates code that is completely compatible with everything else. It's really a nice tool. It is from Macromedia. I'm sorry, it's Macromedia was purchased, but it's from Adobe. And
right.
And it's expensive, about $400. It's not going to be cheap, but it is an excellent tool. You'll find it similar to FrontPage in a lot of ways. It shouldn't be too difficult. In fact, there's even a FrontPage import.
Well, I hear you talk about Ruby on Rails and Ajax.
That's only if you want to write your own code.
Oh, they aren't any WYSIWYG?
No. Those are programming languages. Here's what I would suggest, though. So I said Dreamweaver is the choice for static HTML pages, which is essentially what you're doing right now. But most people now, and the reason I said Dreamweaver is being used less and less, most websites are no longer static. They're dynamic. They use a database running on the server side, MySQL or PostgreSQL, and they use an engine software running on the server side to generate the pages. So essentially, the design is done once, and then there's very easy content management forms for you to add content to. And this is most of the time what I'd recommend people do, even for personal web pages. WordPress is a very good example of that. People think of it as a blogging tool, but it can be used for static websites as well. It just makes it easier to modify and maintain, and you'd only do the design once. You're not coding HTML anymore. So I would look at WordPress if I were you. You're sophisticated enough to be able to install it. I use Drupal and other choices. I'll talk some more about that in just a bit. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Laporte here, the Tech Guy, 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my number. We've been talking with Peter about web design, and really it's a change in how the web is running, kind of. I mean, if you go to almost any site on the internet these days, including all of my sites, they're running content management systems. I mean, nobody is, in fact, there's one very glaring exception, which I'll mention in a second, but if you go to Amazon.com, you don't think Amazon.com has a static page for every product. No, of course not. They have a database, they have a design, and they have software that runs on their servers that takes the data from the database and folds it in using the design, predetermined design, to make the page. And almost all websites run that way these days. I'll tell you what the glaring exception is, oddly enough, is Apple.com. Now, for some reason, Apple hand-codes their pages. That's all hand-coded HTML. You can often tell if a page is hand-coded or created by a generator by looking at the source. You know, almost every browser lets you look at the source code. And if you know what you're looking for, you can almost always tell if something is done by hand or if it's done by a generator. And often the generator will actually put some code in the beginning there and tell you. But Apple's notorious for doing this by hand. Now, if you do it by hand, if you can afford to do it by hand, of course, you have really good coders, you can get slicker pages. They can be beautiful, they can be clean, they can be small. But if you have a lot of pages or a lot of content or not a lot of time, it's just not practical these days. And that's why blogging software has become so popular. That's all blogging software is. It's content management system. WordPress, as an example, uses the MySQL database. I think it also can use PostgreSQL, but it uses a SQL-like database running on the website. It uses the WordPress software running on the web server. And then you do a design. They often call them templates. You can take an existing one or you can make your own or modify an existing one. And that's how it's going to look. And you merge the two. A great way to see how this works is a site called Zen CSS Garden. It's at Zen CSS Garden. Is that the .com? I have to do a Google on it because I can't remember the URL as usual. The idea of this site is to promote this notion of separating content from design, and that's what modern web design is all about. I'm sorry, I've got it reversed. CSSZenGarden.com. So the so what they have is a kind of a generic content page. And then they encourage designers to modify the design, not the content, the design, using something called cascading style sheets, or CSS. So if you go to CSSZenGarden.com, on the right, they'll show you some designs. There's lots of them, hundreds. You click the design, the content doesn't change. It's folded into the new design, and you'll see that the pages can look so different. Completely different depending on the design. And that's the idea. We don't want our content to be mushed in with design. These old tools like Dreamweaver and FrontPage, or even hand-coded HTML, you'd go bracket B, bracket, and then the name, then the text, and then bracket slash B, bracket. You'd have the layout would be intermixed with content. And that's fine for a few pages, but it doesn't scale well. It doesn't grow well. It doesn't grow with you, and it makes it harder to change the design. So by separating the two, we really, it's a much more modern way to go. And that's, you can do this with Dreamweaver, but it's really, generally what most people will do is they'll do a design using tools like Dreamweaver, but then they'll abandon Dreamweaver and they'll maintain their site purely using forms that the web content management system provides. So WordPress, if you go to the administrative page, you know, there's a button, you say write a post or create a new page. And you just create it as if you're doing it in a word processor. You press submit, and then WordPress adds that to the site by merging it with your existing design. So that in the long run is a better way to go. It means you don't have to think about design when you're putting content up, and it doesn't just have to be for blogs. And it means that you can change the design without changing the content. And that's kind of the other power of it. You see, you get sick of your design in 2 years. Instead of having to go back and recode all your pages by hand, you just change the design and everything looks different. All the pages. This is a much better way long term to go. It's really how web sites are designed these days. There are very few sites anymore that are done manually. So if you go to twit.tv, my podcast site, that's running a content management system called Drupal. Drupal. It's free, very powerful, very flexible. More than, I mean, it can do everything. Maybe overkill for a lot of people. The Tech Guy Labs currently is running on a wiki program called PM Wiki. Same idea. I modify a page by editing a page, and I use some special wiki markup, but essentially I'm working in the pure text, and then the wiki engine handles the display. Yeah, the new page that Sasha's designing for us will be Drupal. So it's just easier in the long run to go that way, I think. Daryl's on the line from Van Nuys, California. Hey, Daryl, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yeah, Leo, I bought a Plasma with all of the components, and because I live in a top-floor condominium, I asked the salesman about the problem with transmitting sound and vibration to the people below me, and he assured me that because they have carpeting, it would not be an issue. And unfortunately, I found out after almost a year that the people downstairs from me have been suffering.
I'm so sorry.
All this time. And so I don't know what to do about it. I they're the nicest people in the world.
Let me tell you what transmits and what doesn't. The mid-range and the high-end do not. It's the thumping, right? It's the bass.
Yeah.
So you probably, as many people do, put your subwoofer on the floor.
I do.
And it's conducting right through the floor into their house.
Yep.
Now, it won't sound as good and bassy if you lift it up off the floor, but it won't conduct as thoroughly through the floor. And I suspect that'll improve it by 50% just lifting it up.
Well, I tell you what I did. I went to a store where they sell foam, and
that's another way. Essentially, that's doing the same thing.
I'm sorry.
That's the same thing. It's insulating it from the floor.
Well, I put two layers of quarter inch rubber, which makes half an inch underneath that, and I went downstairs and I asked my neighbors if they
great
could
solution.
Still hear it, and they said,
there's professionally made sound insulating stuff that's got metal and rubber on it. It's very, you know, expensive and complicated. I don't have the name to hand, but I'll tell you what, when we come back, I'll give it to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy at 888-ASK-LEO. 888-ASK-LEO, 888-827-5536. What if you're an apartment dweller and you've got a home theater and you've got noise going down through the floor to your neighbors? That's the problem Daryl had. And just to recapitulate, you know, it's not the high-end usually that goes. It's not the mid-range. It's the subwoofer. It's the bass. Bass travels through walls. The higher the frequency, this is actually analogous to Wi-Fi. The higher the frequency of whether it's sound or electromagnetic, it's all the same. The higher the frequency, the more it'll bounce off of things. So microwave bounces off walls because it's at a very high frequency. Same thing with sound. The higher the frequency of the sound, the more it bounces off things. The lower the frequency, the more it transmits through. So bass, which is anywhere from 20 cycles per second to 150, 200 cycles a second, maybe even 1,000 cycles a second, that goes right through the floor. So his problem is, how do I insulate? Now, he went out and got some rubber. The problem with anything, if it's too dense, it's not going to insulate. It's going to conduct. So there are things designed for insulating the subwoofer. Now, admittedly, you're going to reduce your bass. Part of the reason the subwoofer sounds so good is it's making the floor vibrate. So, you know, you insulate it from the floor, it's going to reduce the bass. But, you know, I understand you don't want your neighbors to, your poor suffering, long-suffering neighbors. DYNAMAT.com, Dynamat.com does acoustic insulation. And they have, we've used the Dynamat. That was the expensive, they're kind of like metal on one side, foam on the other side for computers, to line computers. You could put it in your Xbox. They make kits for that too, but they also make home acoustic solutions. So that's one solution there. There's another one that I'm going to put a link in the show notes to all of this, by the way, techguylabs.com. There's another one made by a company called Oralex, and I've got a review from hometheaterhifi.com, the secrets of home theater and high fidelity, of the Oralex Gramma Isolation Platform. It's only $59. The idea is it's for musicians to insulate their amps or stage monitors so they don't get feedback. But it should also work with a subwoofer. In fact, there's a review of it using it with a subwoofer. The way it works is it's a carpeted piece of probably plywood, half-inch thick carpet, and then it's got sitting on 2x4 insulation foam rails. So the idea is it will insulate. It elevates your subwoofer a few inches. And according to this review, it's not a bad thing to do anyway. He says, thumbs up. This is Brian Florian, again, writing in The Secrets of Home Theater and High Fidelity. Thumbs up to the Gramma, G-R-A-M-M-A. You know what Gramma stands for? It's Gig Recording Amp and Monitor Modulation Attenuator. He says it made a perceptible difference and improved his audio and improved his subwoofer. But he says, don't think of it as a tweak for your sub. It's really for reducing the pass-through. So there's a few things you can do. Just rubber isn't going to work. You need something that's going to insulate in the same way, you know, foam rubber insulates better than rubber because it's got air in there. And it's audio insulation is what you want. So interesting problem that all of us city dwellers face. I'll put some more links in here. Here's a thread on the Audioholics forums. Same issue. He's got a clip subwoofer, lives on the third floor of a condo, and there's a lot of different suggestions in here, including motion actuators. No, that can't be right. That's not a good solution. That makes your seat rumble. That seems like a bad idea. 888-ASK-LEO is the number. Coming up in just a bit, our weekly giz whiz, Dick DiBartolo, talking about some cool gadget or other. I know he's always got something interesting up his sleeve. Let's get back to the phones. Warren on line 3 from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Warren. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What can I do for you?
I'm sending my daughter off to college. This is the first child that I'm sending off to college.
Oh, boy.
And I sort of feel like it's having a baby all over again with all the purchases. It's kind of driving me crazy. So I got her a MacBook, and I thought that was a pretty good start.
I think it is.
And now I find out that she needs a TV. So we go out and we take a look, and I see that there's some very nice LCD small, which will fit on the small desk that they'll be having, that also will work as computer monitors. So the problem is, I'd like to be able to plug it in and see how it looks from the MacBook, but the MacBook has a mini DVI connector.
Yeah, you have a...
And I'm looking at HDMIs and apparently VGA connectors.
The MacBook will drive that. It comes with a dongle in the box that goes from that funny connector on the side of the MacBook to a DVI out. And then you can get a connector that'll go DVI to HDMI. It's not very expensive because it's electrically the same. Now, here's my question to you. How is she going to receive TV? Is it a cable? Is it antenna?
They do have cable in the rooms.
Okay. Cable television, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Well, that's an option.
Times
Dad hasn't decided if he's going
to
spray
Dad has to pay for it. I was going to say, times have changed since I was... You had to go down to the common room and watch whatever they were watching.
Exactly.
So there is an option to run it on the Mac. I know that's a smaller monitor, but she could actually watch TV. She can watch DVDs on the Mac, and she can watch TV on the Mac, too. There are options for that.
Right, but I'm thinking with that 13-inch MacBook monitor,
small.
It really would be nice to have a second monitor to be able to have your research up and then have your Word document on.
Well, there is an issue on the MacBook. It doesn't drive... I guess it does. I'm trying to remember the capabilities of the Mac. You're gonna have to pay attention to what resolutions it can output, because it's not as quite as capable as the MacBook Pro. It does do two screens. It will drive two screens.
Okay.
But I think the resolutions are limited, so you'll want to pay attention to what you're capable of on that second screen.
Right. That's sort of exactly my question, because there's a variety of different options, and it looks like a 720p option LCD TV would be a pretty reasonable TV. And they come up with a 1024 by 768 resolution.
Oh, yeah. You'll be able to drive that very easily.
Okay.
That's not a problem.
And would that be adequate for doing TV monitor?
Yeah, it'd be good for TV. It would be, and in fact, when she runs it as a computer monitor, she'll probably want to run it at a higher resolution. But this is the issue, is if you want to use it as a second computer monitor, I probably wouldn't buy a TV. I'd buy a computer monitor that can run as a TV. So, for instance, you could buy the Dell 24-inch widescreen, which I'm pretty sure that Mac could drive. And it has TV in. It has HDMI in. It has cable. I believe it has cable in. It has TV inputs on it. Certainly has component. You'd probably want a cable. They probably give you a cable box, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So coming out of that cable box would be component, probably, and it has component in on that monitor. So something like the Dell 24, let me check and see if it will run with the MacBook. I'm pretty sure that's the biggest size it'll run on the MacBook. You could then use it as a second monitor. You'd have your MacBook screen and your Dell. It's about $700, $800. The Dell would look like a computer monitor. See, computer monitors are higher resolution than TV. 1024 by 768 is very low for a screen that size if you're going to use it as a computer monitor. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And then the other question is, do you use the Vega or do you use the HDMI? Because that seems to be the two options for these monitors.
You may not have HDMI as an option. Oh, I see, VGA or HDMI. Yeah, use on that monitor you could use either, and it's generally better to use digital, which is HDMI.
HDMI.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter that much. These Dell 24s, for instance, handle analog inputs quite well, and they end up looking almost as good with analog as they do with digital.
Okay.
That's the difference.
Great.
VGA is analog, HDMI is digital.
And then in terms of staying in touch with her, what do you recommend for a webcam for a Mac-using family?
She's got one.
She's got it built into her MacBook, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, she's got one. And you have a Mac at home or a PC?
Macs. We're Mac family.
Unfortunately, Apple stopped selling its iSight. Which is odd, because the iSight was their camera, and it worked very well. Do you have a camcorder, a DV camcorder?
We have one, yeah.
Yeah, you can use that.
Okay.
So you'll take the FireWire from the camcorder into the Mac. The Mac has FireWire in, and you can use... I would recommend using Skype. Give you a better picture quality, much better audio quality. She can use Skype on her end, you use Skype on yours, and the Skype will see your camcorder as a video input.
Okay.
And it looks fantastic.
And I hear you talk about the DSP-400 Plantronics headset to use for Skype.
Yep.
They actually have the 500 at their store. So they're still selling that for a really good price. How does that compare?
Get it. It's better. The 400 folds. That's the biggest difference.
Oh, is that right?
So if you're traveling with it, the 400 is probably better. They discontinued the 500 for reasons I'm not completely sure of. I had a 500 and loved it.
Right.
So my recommendation was the 500 till I couldn't buy it anymore. I didn't realize they were still selling it at Plantronics.
It's on the Plantronics website, I see.
Yeah.
They have it as a discontinued product.
Right. I don't know why they discontinued it. Maybe because it was a little pricey. Excellent.
For about $30 now.
Get it. Get two.
Okay. Thank you so much, Leo.
I'm going to run over there and buy some now, too. Hey, congratulations.
Great. We're very proud of her.
That's very exciting. She going to Wisconsin? Where's she going?
University of Minnesota, Twin Cities.
Excellent. Won't be too far away.
We're very excited.
That's great.
Just far enough away, she says.
Exactly. Not too far, but far enough so Mom and Dad won't be popping in on the weekends.
There you go.
Take care, Warren. Yeah, this is exciting time, right? A lot of people have family and kith and kin and kids going to college. We can talk more about college computing. 8888 Ask Leo. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888 Ask Leo. That's the number to call, 8888 Ask Leo. I think we're talking about college computing. Laptops, a good way to go, of course. Kids are going to want laptops. Remember, though, that they are the 10 speeds of this generation. When we went to school, everybody got their 10 speeds stolen, their bikes stolen, right? Now that's going to be the laptops. And so you've got to instill in your child's head. They never leave it alone. They don't go to the library and leave it there when they go to the bathroom. Or if they do, they lock it up. And probably not a bad idea to get them one of those Kensington-style locks. All laptops have a little connector on it that these cable locks go into. There's one called the DEFCON that has an alarm. If the cable gets snipped, that's probably a good choice. They're deterrent. They're not going to keep it from being stolen if somebody's determined, but they're a good deterrent. I'll put a link in the show notes to the DEFCON. And the other issue, of course, is an entertainment center. And I think, frankly, unless you've got more than one kid watching, plays DVDs, make sure they bring a good set of speakers, because then it's their stereo system as well. Really, the computer now is everything that we used to bring: a stereo, maybe a little TV. Didn't have computers in my time. You'd bring a typewriter. But now all of that's in one. Generally, they don't need to bring printers. Most schools have printers on the network. Whether you encourage gaming is up to you. I think the nice thing about giving them a MacBook is you're not going to see much gaming on the MacBook. It's really more focused on work. But you should check with the school before you go to see if they support Macs and Windows equally. Some schools might be very Windows specific or very Mac specific, and that might lean you in one direction or the other. I think a MacBook is an excellent, frankly, computer for a kid going to school for the first time, or, you know, even seniors and grad students. Back to the phones we go. Scott is on the line from Stowe, Ohio. Hey, Scott. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
And the reason why I was calling is about a month ago, I bought a airport Extreme base station before they switched over to Gigabit Ethernet.
Me too.
Port.
You and me both.
And the interaction works fine with my XP machine, but with my Vista machine and a USB hard drive plugged into the base station, I can't transfer files. I can transfer individual files, but I can't, for some reason, transfer files to the Vista machine that are, I can't transfer subdirectories.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Are you using airport disk? Are you using the airport disk capabilities?
Yeah, I'm using the airport disk capability. It sees the drive just fine. And in XP, it works normally, but with Vista, files are... individual files I can transfer, like if I go into a subdirectory and pull the file down, it works. But the subdirectory itself, I can't transfer. I get an error from Vista saying that it the file I'm trying to transfer is no longer located at the drive it's mounted at.
I'm looking on Apple's website, and apparently there are some issues. Apple uses something called Samba to do Windows networking. Samba's a great program. It was written, it's an open source emulation of the old Windows SMB networking, LAN manager. And it does a very good job, but you do have to have the latest version of Samba for it to work well. Apparently, I'm reading this on the, and I'll put a link in the show notes in the Apple discussion forums, that there are issues with accessing copying files when using Samba fast queries on a device that only supports slow queries. And apparently, unless you update the Samba drivers, you're only going to get slow queries. Now, there is an update. Yeah, there is an update. Make sure you get, I presume you're up installing the updates for the, they just pushed one, in fact, the other day for the Airport Extreme. So make sure you're getting those.
I just installed the updates to the disk utility they have.
Did that improve the situation?
No, it didn't. And even when, and this is funny too, even when directly connected, when I have the drive directly connected to the Vista machine, it won't transfer the subdirectories. It'll only transfer the files if I pull them out one at a time.
Well, I'm going to put a link in the show notes to a blog at builderau.com, which talks specifically about Vista and Samba issues. And I believe, I may be wrong, but I believe that's what you're seeing, is the incompatibility with the way Vista is set up and the way the Samba is set up on the Airport. And one of the things they suggest is there is a, you can change the way that Samba works. In particularly, the one of the problems is the NTLM V2 authentication, and you could change that. So I'm going to, you know, this is one of those things where, you know, you're just going to have to try some stuff. I'll put links to both of these discussions on there. It appears that this is an issue. It's an incompatibility between Vista and the Airport Extreme, and particularly the Airport Disk. But I gather from reading these threads that people have been able to fix it.
That's interesting, because I contacted Apple, and
as usual,
you know, they acted like they had never heard of it before.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, it's a very kind of specific issue. And if you got, a lot of times when you call tech support, it's how good the guy you got is. If he's looking in the notebook, let me see. No, nothing in here. That's not the guy you want. You want the guy who's been on doing this for 3 years, has heard every question possible, and has solved a number of them. And a lot of times that's what you're hoping for with tech support, is somebody who's been through it before. Anyway, I'm going to put these links in the show notes. You take a look, see if it helps. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Unlimited local and long distance calling for less than $20 a month. Call 888-60-POWER. That's 888-60-POWER. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hello, good to see you. We're going to get back to the phones in just a bit at 888-ASK-LEO. But before we do, I would very much like to get my good friend, Mads Maddestrider, Mr. Dick DiBartolo, in here, because he's got a crazy, wacky gadget. Hello, Dick.
Hey, Leo. How you doing?
Well, how's it going on the What the Heck Is It contest?
You're going to get posted in the month. What are we? It's the 12th.
Well, we're halfway through the month, I guess.
We're halfway through the month. Yeah. Getting a lot of funny answers, and a couple of people really knew what it was. It's, you know, it's on the opening page.
It looks like a little saw or something. I can't quite figure out what it is.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, that would be.
That's my guess, anyway.
That's fine. That can be your guess. And, oh, wait a minute, Leo. There's someone at my.
Is that somebody at your cubicle?
Did someone at my cubicle? This Leo, this is just such a funny idea. It was invented by a guy who actually listens to our nonsense daily at the Daily Gizwiz. His name is Mike Musalone. I'm probably murdering his name. Uh-huh. But he said, Dick, I invented the cubicaller.
The cubicaller.
The cubicle. Because, you know, when you sit at a cubicle, normally your back is toward your, you know, facing where the people are standing,
yeah.
And they stamp their feet, they shuffle papers, they drop stuff, they cough, they clear their throat, trying to get your attention. So instead, this little guy's like 3 by 3 inches. So instead of doing that, you can put up your little cubicle, which has a little push button like a doorbell. And I think you're at cubicle.com.
I am. Shall I play the sound?
Yeah. Play. There are a choice of 12 different sounds, which sound like this.
All right. This is what would, you know, all together. Here we go. There's the birds. A guga phone. That's nice. That's a good one.
Doorbell. That's good.
Oh, but that. Oh. See, that's, I like it.
That's very showbiz.
It is. Oh, you'd think there was a cat in the cubicle. That's good. I like those. I think I would use the knock, 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 knock.
Yeah, that's good. I would use the fanfare one. Very showbiz.
But, yeah. You know, this is a really real, this is not a fake problem. This is a genuine problem.
The guy, it's a genuine problem.
If you've ever worked in a cubicle farm, people sneak up on you. I used to work with people who would have rear view mirrors on their computer monitors just so they could see who was coming into the cubicle. But this is better. This way you can announce yourself.
Exactly. And it comes with two little Velcro strips. And also, Velcro is good because you could take it off and stick it in your drawer so no one takes it.
When the boss comes.
Yeah, and has a little volume control on it, a 3-step volume control. So if it's noisy, you can put it on loud, or a very quiet office. Like if you work in a funeral parlor, you could put it on low, low, low.
This is fun. You know, I think people who work in cubicles need I used to work in a cubicle. You need some creativity to make, because they all look the same.
You need
something to dress it up a little bit.
Absolutely. And the great thing is when Mike queried me about it, you know, I said it sounds like a great idea, but I was hoping this is not going to be like $40. It's $11.99.
Perfect.
And it's a cleverly
gift.
Designed.
It's
a great gag gift also.
Yeah, you could
give
this
for those office
party.
Gifts and you don't know what to give
Secret
somebody.
Secret Santa. This is great because you know the Secret Santa, they do that, and then you're limited to like $10 or something. You're limited to some ridiculous amount of money. You can't get anything for that. So this is.
Oh, I thought Secret Santa was a gadget. Oh, no, you mean
you know? You don't work in an office, so you probably don't know.
No,
they'll do a Secret Santa in the office where you have to give a gift to one person, but they don't know who's giving them the gift.
Oh,
that
I
way
see.
You don't have to give a gift to everybody in the office. You have a drawing, and then you say, "Oh, good." You know, I got Sarah Lane, so I'll be getting her a gift or, you know, whatever. And then you pick the gift, and she doesn't know who gave her the gift.
Oh, that's the way you work the payroll up on Lab with Leo.
You'll never know who's going to get the paycheck.
Who's
going to
pay
week.
You your check.
Yeah, it's kind of a mystery.
It's great.
Will this be my week to get paid?
Yeah.
Very clever.
I went up there 3 times now, and it's never been my week
Never
to get
been
paid.
Your week.
Well, no.
Can I tell you a little secret?
So I have to keep going. Yeah.
We never pay anybody. It's just a joke. Isn't that funny?
Yeah. Okay. Now I get it. I guess now I don't get it.
You never will get it. Cubicaller and it's cubicaller.com.
And $11.99.
This is a silly gadget, but you know, I think he's going to do very well.
I think he is too. Yeah. I think he hit on something that's a common problem, and you'll probably get more traffic at your cubicle because people want to.
They want to ring your bell. Come ring my chime.
Ring your chimes.
There you go. Dick DiBartolo is in Mad Magazine every single issue this week or this month. It's the Simpsons cover, and you've got an article on where the money for the iPhone
where your
goes.
Money, where when you buy an iPhone, where your dollars go.
I love it. You can also catch him every day on the Daily Gizwiz on twit.tv, twit.tv, and every week here on the show. Go to his website, gizwiz.biz, for a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. All you have to do is guess, what the heck is that? It's the What the Heck Is It contest. It's a lot of fun. Do you still have the caps? Are you still selling the caps?
Oh, yeah, Leo. I'm down to 14 of them.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. But, you know, next time we talk, I'll talk about the Inca pen, which is the second thing I'm ever going to sell. You know, the pen that writes upside down,
like,
and everything.
I like the ink pen, yeah.
Yeah, well, you look in your FedEx when you get home, and you'll see what they look like.
A little
and then
bribe,
next
huh?
time we talk, you'll say, ooh. Well, I hope you like that.
All right, Dick.
Practice.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us. We'll see you next time.
I'll be here.
He's the greatest. Gizwiz.biz. That's his website. And by the way, I've been remiss. I haven't mentioned all of the links I've been giving out are on our website, techguylabs.com. Techguylabs.com. Shuby keeps those show notes. We're redesigning. Sasha and I are about to launch the new site any day now. We thought we might do it this week. Sasha wanted to do some final finishing touches, so maybe next week. The new site will have a lot of nice features, including the ability, something I've missed, frankly, for some time, the ability for you to comment to add your content to the page. So if you want to correct or add to what I say, which happens a lot for some reason, yeah, you can do it on the website, techguylabs.com. Right now, you can do it, of course, in our chat room. There are 374 people in there. That's irc.dslextreme.com, and I visit during breaks, irc.dslextreme.com. And finally, we do have video of the show, live streaming video, thanks to the folks at ustream.tv and stickum.com. Today, Ustream has my camera, so you see my smiling face and my wacky shirt. And Stickum's got the close-ups of my screen. So as I'm talking about stuff, I'll zoom in on the screen and you could see what I'm talking about. We could catch both of those. We have links on the website, but if you want, you can go directly to twit.tv/live and you could see both video screens on one page. We're working on making that a little slicker as well. In fact, I'm actually working on making it even more of a television production. It's call me crazy. Call me wacky. Let's say hi to Chris, Denver, Colorado. You're next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Chris.
Leo, how are you today?
I'm great. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing well, thanks. I want to thank you for taking my call. I'm a big fan. Listen to the podcast.
Marvelous. I appreciate that.
You are helping me to release my inner geek.
I used to work with a woman named Kate Botello. On a TV show called The Screensaver, she was my co-host. She used to say to everybody, namaste. And I said, what, namaste? She said, yes, that means the geek in me recognizes the geek within you. So namaste.
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 Hey, wanted to get your opinion. I have to admit, I am probably one of, I've got three computers, all running Windows XP Pro.
Oh,
and
you're
they all
a
are
geek.
Working fine, so
oh,
I don't have
you're
a problem.
A geek. Yes.
I've got a hard drive enclosure, recently purchased a Western Digital 320 gig drive to use for backups.
Excellent.
Wanted to get your opinion. Good backup practices. One night I went, and since it's got enough to, there's enough space on that new hard drive to back up everything on my primary computer, both hard drives that I have in that, I just did, said, use the Windows backup utility, said, just back it all up. Where is overkill, or is there overkill?
That's overkill, right there.
Yeah,
it's not a bad thing to do. There are a couple of things I don't like about that. One is the Windows backup utility. What it does is instead of just backing up files, it makes a big ball of stuff,
which is what I've got.
And you can't look into it. You can't really verify it except using that program. I like backing up. I certainly agree that it's best to back up with a tool that does it automatically, but I like it where it's just plain copies, where it copies the folders and files. You can look in there. You can see the files. You can see the folders. You can see you got everything you want. You can open one just to check it. If you're missing a file, you don't need to use any special tool to recover it. And when you reinstall Windows, you don't have to get the backup program up and running. You just go, well, let me drag these files back. So I like just plain old copying for backup. I don't think the idea of smushing into a ball is not a good idea. Secondarily, you backed up more than you needed to because...
That's what I was concerned about.
Right. Obviously, you don't need Windows. You don't need the applications. Generally, this is how I like to think of backup. First of all, remember that what we're doing as home users is a little different than what a business does. A business does backup everything because for a business, the key is to get backup online as fast as possible. And they're paying employees to take the time to do these backups. They're willing to spend the time up front so they can get back in business as quickly as possible. In general, for a home user, it's kind of the opposite. You want to make it as easy as possible for you to do the backup. You're willing to take the time to do the restore because it's not going to be critical that you get it done as fast as possible. So make it easy, otherwise you won't do it.
Exactly.
I think you're what you've done absolutely right is an external drive is the easiest, fastest way to do it. Now, there's a problem with that. If you leave that external drive right next to the computer and there's a fire or a flood or an earthquake, you've lost everything anyway. So you need to do something also called off-site backups. Periodically, not doesn't have to be that often, but it depends on what your pain level would be if you lost everything in between backups. And that's for most people is pretty high, but at least week, you know, at least monthly, maybe weekly. I'd back up to a CD or a DVD, critical stuff that you really want, and bring it somewhere.
Right.
You know, Steve Gibson gives it to his mom. Put it in a safe deposit box. Many people bring it to work. That's what I do. Bring it to the office. That way, you've got a copy in two different places, and it's much less likely. You know, one of our advertisers, Carbonite, also solves this problem. That's an online backup. And that's kind of neat because then it's not even on your site. It's on a server somewhere. This is a great question. I want to talk more about it, Chris, so hang on the line. We're going to take a break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Today, Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
I can't believe the news today.
8888 Ask Leo.
Oh, I can't close my eyes.
So we're talking with Chris about really an important subject. I wanted to take a little more time, which is backup. How do you backup? What do you backup? And the point number one is backup for consumers is different than backup for business. You don't backup everything. You backup the data you've created, and you make it as easy as possible to back it up on a regular basis, whether that's an external hard drive and a program. What I would recommend is a program running on your system that automatically synchronizes to the external hard drive. Microsoft makes a program called SyncToy for free that'll do that on the Mac. Super Duper will do that. So these are programs that are running in the background all the time and will keep the external hard drive synchronized. Now, I wouldn't synchronize it with the whole system. I would synchronize it just with your data, maybe the documents and settings folder if you wanted to get a lot of stuff, or just your login, your home folder, or if you know everything's in My Documents, just get My Documents. You have to think about what is it that I want to back up? What can I not afford to lose? Certainly, you know, your photos and your music and your videos, those are critical. You don't want to lose those. But that's an on-site backup. And that's the easy one to do, the fast one, the one you can get to quickly. You should also have off-site backup. You do that less often. But for instance, photos, whenever I import a new roll, I burn a CD or a DVD and I take that off-site. Because photos are precious. You don't want to lose those. Or you can use an online backup service. As I mentioned, Carbonite is a sponsor. For Mac people, there's a program, a company called Mozy does the same thing, mozy.com. So ease of backup, ease of restore, in the sense that you can see what you've got and you can copy file by file, and then off-site. Those are the three critical things. I also use image backup, and this is more of a specialized thing, something you might want to look at, Chris. It depends on how often you want to reinstall the operating system.
Well, and our current system, I think, is probably 3 or 4 years old. We've never done a reinstall. I've been lucky, but it's slowing down. It's time to do it.
I just did my MacBook that's about a year old, and boy, it just speeded everything up. Plus, it cleans it off. I mean, there's a lot of programs. I don't know about you, but I install a lot of extra stuff and never use it again. So it's good to get rid of all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm sure I've got a bunch of stuff in the registry just gunking up the works, so to speak.
Precisely. Windows especially likes to be reinstalled at least yearly. So if you make an image, the problem with images is, you know, this takes a little more effort. It's something more of an IT department thing. But an image is what you did, kind of what you did, where it does a bit-for-bit copy of what's on the hard drive, which makes it easy to quickly reinstall it. I do an image, for Windows particularly, I'll do an image after I do the initial install and update, so I get all the updates in there. Then I'll do another image with all my applications installed. And I keep those on a second drive. Nowadays, drives are so cheap. It's not a big deal to have a 500 gigabyte hard drive just, you know, attached to your system. I keep those on a second drive just in case. And I learned that from years in TV where, you know, the system would go down. We got 2 minutes during commercials to get it back up. And the beauty of an image install is it's fast. You don't go through the Windows install. It's already activated. It just restores it.
Gotcha.
So that's a nice thing. That's a kind of icing on the cake. Not necessary, but a nice thing to have.
Gotcha.
All right.
Well, great. I was hoping I could ask one last quick question.
Certainly.
In October, I'm coming out to your neck of the woods, except I'll be in the lower part of Silicon Valley in Monterey for a little vacation.
Oh,
I'm
also taking
also coming out to take a class to, again, help to nurture my inner geek. You and Steve Gibson have sufficiently scared me about using my laptop on a wireless network at a hotel. Is there a good program like a Hotspot VPN or something you'd recommend so that I can, if I'm checking my email, I'm not sending passwords and usernames out in the clear?
Yeah, Hotspot VPN is very good. I actually use them. There is a guy who's a listener who's created a service, I think, called MyVPN. Same idea, less expensive. A VPN is one solution. Your business may have a VPN, virtual private network, that you can log into. What that does is encrypts all your data from your system to the VPN server, whether that's at your business or at a commercial entity like Hotspot VPN or MyVPN. So the hotel, the Wi-Fi access point, nobody can see anything. But, you know, if it's just email, it's sufficient to have an encrypted connection to your email. And many email providers, Gmail will do this, your ISP may, will offer SSL links to the email for login. And by the way, you want to ask them, is it login and all of the email back and forth or just the login? You want both.
Right.
If they offer that, then you don't mind if somebody sees what pages you go to, then I think that's probably adequate. That's really all I do most of the time. Use SSL when you're logging into your email and when you're transacting your email. Use SSL when you're on a banking site, of course. Anywhere that you don't want anybody to see your password. And then the rest of the time, so they see that I'm going to look at the latest Dilbert cartoon. Big deal. You know, that's not a value to anybody. I don't feel the need to encrypt that. Okay?
Okay.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, great. Leo, thank you very much, and namaste.
Namaste. Great to talk to you. We're going to take that over. The geek in me recognizes, I think namaste is the Buddhist greeting. The God in me recognizes the God in you. But we're going to take that over and make the geek in me. We'll make an ecumenical version. The geek in me recognizes the geek in you. Cameron in Novato, California, just down the road. Hi, Cameron. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hey, Leo. I have a question about installing AutoCAD onto my computer. I'm going to Dartmouth next year, and they don't really require it, but they highly suggest that we have AutoCAD before we get there.
Are you going to an engineering program?
Yeah.
Hey, that's fantastic. I hear your milkshake. I don't know what that is. I think that's a prank. We were just talking in the chat room, and maybe Cameron's in the chat room, about how I only got pranked once by a Howard Stern listener. And I don't know if my milkshake qualifies as a prank or not, but anyway. So I don't know anything about installing AutoCAD, but I think you probably will want to bring it with you to Dartmouth, and good luck. I don't know. See, I think I have time to get one more, and if not, we'll take a break and then come back. Jason in, is it Mankato, Michigan, or Minnesota?
Mankato, Minnesota.
Mankato. Nice to talk to you, Jason.
Good to hear from you, too. I wanted to first say thank you to you and Megan for getting me energized to get my family stuff put on the web.
Great.
Megan's done with Jumping Monkeys.
Megan does a podcast called Jumping Monkeys with me, and it's a parenting podcast, and she has a great site called Jumping Monkeys. So what are you putting on the net? We're out of time. Hold on. Just hang on. We'll take you back when darn this top of the hour thing. Got a break for news from your local stations, but we've got lots more to come. 8888 Ask Leo. I'm Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Good day to you. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. 888-827-5536. That's my number. Coming up, Steve Gibson, our security guru. We were talking with Chris and mentioning different ways to go securely online. And I mentioned Hotspot VPN. The other one that was started by a listener, which looks pretty good, is v4vpn.com. I thought it was MyVPN. It's v4vpn.com. $5 a month, $49.50 a year. Seems like a great solution. V4VPN.com. Josh Wilmarth. Who I'm trying to remember. He's a high school kid, and I think he listens to the radio show, or he listens to the podcasts. But I think this is so cool. And he's using the same server company that I am, which is a very robust, excellent server system. So it should work quite well. V4VPN.com. I'm glad to give him a little recommendation. It's kind of neat to see a high school student starting a business, really a viable business. It's a great idea. And because it's a little smaller, it might be a little more responsive, believe it or not. We were talking about, what was it on the last call?
Backups.
Have we lost him? What line was I on? Oh, no. Oh, there it is. It's Jason. I'm sorry, Jason. I see you now. I haven't lost you at all.
Hello.
Hey. So let's get back to the question. I'm sorry I cut you off. You said some nice things, and all of a sudden I said bye. But thanks, thanks for hanging on. What can I do for you today?
I'm a PC user right now, looking at going over to Macs fairly soon.
Boy, I'm seeing this more and more. It's very interesting.
And there's a couple things that I currently do with my PC, with my laptop, that I'm just a little hesitant moving forward.
Okay.
With the with the blog that you and Megan have started and got me hooked on, I'm doing a lot more photo, moving stuff over.
What's your blog? Can we look at it, or is it private?
Sure.
Family only?
No, it's open.
Where is it?
It's mygeekdaddy.blogspot.com.
I love it. Mygeekdaddy.blogspot.com. So it's a daddy blog.
Yes.
And you're putting pictures on there, and this is great. This is really great. This is just a good example of, Blogger is a very good example of what we were talking about earlier, a content management system. It's free. They provide the server. And it's very easy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's been wonderful. It's, as my wife put it, it's another hobby to add to the list.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. Now, a couple other services I also like for this purpose. Vox is one, VOX.com. And another that I'm very fond of that's free is WordPress.com. All of the same idea. They provide the server. The software, and you just put your stuff up.
Now, WordPress allows you to have more than one page, though?
Yes. Why? Is this limited to one page?
Well, Blogspot looks like I'm limited to one page, just a continuous stream of what I've got.
Oh.
Does WordPress allow for...
No. I think what you do is you tell Blogspot how many entries on the front page, and then it'll go to older posts. So as you see right now, in fact, if I go to the bottom of your page, there's a link to older posts. Do you mean one page design? Is that what you mean?
It goes to the older posts, but like, for example, one of the things I wanted to do for some of my family was like a tips page and keep a constant record of that versus reposting something.
Yeah, that's a limitation. Blogger is really pretty straightforward. It's blogging only. WordPress is much more sophisticated. And yes, WordPress, now I have to check to see if WordPress.com gives you the full functionality of WordPress. If it does, yes, it allows you to create kind of non-blog pages, just text content pages.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that's the case with the WordPress.com as well.
Okay. What ultimately it was is moving to the Mac, I've got photos and moving stuff from, my camcorder.
Mm-hmm.
Ripping DVDs so my youngster doesn't crash them.
Yep.
And I'm looking between, the more compact MacBook versus what appears to be the more powerful MacBook Pro.
You've decided on a laptop for sure, though, huh?
I'd like to get a laptop for sure. Yeah, I travel about two times a week.
I have both, and I love both of them. The MacBook Pro, the biggest difference, besides the size, which is obviously a big difference, is the video subsystem. The video subsystem's faster on the Pro, and that's really what they're selling on the Pro. So if you needed to do video editing, Final Cut, not iMovie video editing, Final Cut video editing, or 3D rendering, or big fancy presentations, you might want a Pro. But I think the MacBook is a great choice to do all of the things you're talking about, including iMovie.
Okay.
Just fine.
The other part that I have at home, though, is I've got Windows Home Server, the beta client.
How do you like that?
I love it. I mean, all my stuff's backed up. I've got a removable drive in there that I switch out and bring to my office then, and it so far has, when I pulled the old drive out, put the new drive in, it's seen it just fine, and I just leave my laptops up at night and my wife's computer up at night, and it's backed up and worked great for me so far. However, is there a similar product to use for a Mac computer?
Well, yeah, actually, you probably can use Windows Home Server still.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Mac doesn't have any problem with Windows networking. It acts like it uses Samba to act like a Windows machine. So I don't see that you would have any trouble. I mean, with Windows Home Server, are you running a client on the desktop Windows machines to connect to it?
There is a small client, but that's more for the interface to configure the server.
So that you obviously won't be able to run on a Mac. But,
right.
But you still have Windows machines, so you can do that to configure it. But no, the Mac looked like a network attached storage device. As far as I know, I haven't yet run Windows Home Server. That's why I was asking you about it. But as far as I know, it acts just like a network attached storage device. If you're using a Mac and you can use any NAS solution, NAS solution, absolutely. I use an Infront, which is running Unix. It's not, the Mac just looks like another computer. You don't have to use an Apple specific solution.
Okay. My only concern was it being, more Microsoft centric product.
Yeah, well, I understand that concern, and the truth is I don't know yet. I haven't tried it. I should set up a Windows Home Server unit and see. But my guess is it would absolutely not have any trouble with that.
Okay.
The Mac, look at Apple has to live in a Windows world, right?
Exactly.
So Apple does everything it can to interoperate with Windows. I wish it were a two-way street. Microsoft doesn't do that on their side, but they don't have to. They're 95% of the market. So when you bring an Apple into a Windows network, it behaves just like a Windows machine.
And the last thing part was, I do rip DVDs for personal use. Is the video subsystem on a MacBook Pro going to, speed that up?
No,
or is it CPU intensive?
No, it's all CPU.
Okay.
Doesn't make any difference.
Wonderful.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jason. I really appreciate it. And I just found out IOStream, who's CTO, apparently he's a chief technical officer for IOStream, says they use Windows Home Server, and in fact, they are backing up Macs over the network using WHS. So there you go. There you go. Now you know. I am going to review the new iMac and the new iLife and iWork packages in just a minute. I've been playing with them all week. I'll give you a thumbnail review. Not a detailed review in just a second. Let's say hi to Matt in Ottawa, Canada. Hello, Matt. Leo Laporte here, the tech guy.
Hello.
Hey, Matt.
Hey.
What can I do for you today?
I want to know if I can install and run Vista Home Premium off an external USB drive.
It depends on the computer. Some computers will boot from a USB drive.
It's my MacBook, so.
Oh, yeah. In that case, yes, you should. The MacBook can boot off a USB drive.
And I won't have any problems installing it?
That's an interesting question. I haven't tried it, but I don't see any reason. Let me think. That's because you'll have to use Boot Camp to do it.
Okay.
I don't know. I'm going to have to ask and see if anybody's done that.
Okay. I have a second question if I could get in quick.
It may be an issue with Vista, by the way. Vista itself may not boot via USB. Yes, your second question.
Every time I start up my computer, all my folders default to the icon view, except for the applications that always goes to column. And I went into the Finder Preferences. I can't find it anywhere to get it.
Yeah, if you go to the Finder Preferences, you can select under the General tab, Open New Windows in Column View. And it will remember that. It sometimes takes a little while. If you've opened them before in icon view, it will remember your previous setting. So it will open an icon view until you say go into column view from now on, and then it'll stay that way. And then new windows should open in column view. Whenever I have a new Mac, I have to slowly kind of train it to use column view because that's what I use all the time. But after a while, it'll recognize it. And from then on, all the windows they open in the view that you use last. And if you tell them column view, it'll stay in column view. And if you it's in the Finder under Preferences, Finder Preferences, in the General section. You check that box that says Open New Windows in Column View. You should be okay. Show notes are online, techguylabs.com. Thanks for the call, by the way, Matt. Techguylabs.com. Chat room is live. Almost 400 people in there. It's great. I love having all these people in here. Thanks to Dan and Dustin and Illuminati and Mick and Mike and Shuby, who are maintaining the decorum in the chat room. You can go there by going to irc.dslextreme.com. We do thank DSL Extreme for providing the server for that. irc.dslextreme.com. And yeah, there's video. Video both of my desktop and of me at twit.tv/live. Or you can link to it from techilabs.com. twit.tv/live. My review of the iMac, coming up in just a bit. More of your calls, too, at 8888-ASK-LEO. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Support the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's my number. We're talking about technology. Coming up, Steve Gibson, our security guru. More of your calls, too. So I bought the new iMac. Wanted to test it out. I don't generally do review units or loaners or gifts from companies because I want to have the... first of all, I don't want to owe a company anything. I want to be able to be completely honest. So that's, you know, I bought it and I bought the new iLife and the new iWork as well. And, I have to say, I'm very, very impressed. It's a beautiful machine, aluminum, works well. I think some complaints, from some people about the glossy, you don't have a choice. LCD panels can either be glossy or matte finish on the panel. Most of the panels people use are matte. And what that merely means is the panel is kind of roughed up effectively so it doesn't reflect light. And there's a negative to that. It kind of blocks light as well, so it can affect the color and the clarity of the display. Glossy doesn't do that. Display shines right through, but because it's glossy, it also reflects light. So depends on your lighting situation where you're going to look at the Mac. In an Apple store, for instance, with a lot of bright fluorescent lights, it can be very annoying. But if you can position your iMac... And it is very easy to move around in position. If you can position it where it's not reflecting light, it looks gorgeous. And it is really a great way to look at photos, video, and movies. It's just beautiful. I got the 24-inch display, and it's silent. I got the top of the line, the very highest processor. I was a little worried that 2.8 gigahertz Core 2 Intel CPU might be a little hot. It's got a 7200 RPM, 500 gigabyte drive in there. I thought it might get a little warm. In fact, it runs very cool. And best of all, for a home computer, it's silent. I set it up in the living room and actually used a Drobo to copy stuff over to it. And the Drobo is fairly noisy, external drive. And my wife said, is that noise going to continue? Is that something we're going to live with in the living room? I said, no, that's just temporary. It's the external drive. I'm copying stuff over. When I turned off the Drobo, took it out of the room, the Mac is dead silent, and it's really a nice piece of furniture. It actually looks very good. Some complaints also about the choice of keyboard. Apple's using those keys that it made famous on the MacBook. It's not a lot of travel in the keys. On the other hand, the keyboard is very thin and beautiful. I mean, the overall look of the iMac is gorgeous. The keyboard, you know, I like a little more travel. This is, again, a personal decision, just like the glossy screen. You should probably try before you buy. And you can always get a different keyboard. You're not stuck with this keyboard. But I have to say, the low profile of it, and it just looks gorgeous. My kids don't seem to mind typing on it. It hasn't slowed me down or bothered me too much. But again, I have a MacBook, so I'm kind of used to it. But overall, I think a very good computer. A little pricey, of course. They start at $1,299, and the model I got, I think, was over $2,000. But I have to say, for a home computer, I think it's a very good system. Comes with a new iLife, which is an excellent package. Some complaints over iLife, particularly iMovie, because iMovie's changed so much. It's really a new program. Apple probably should have renamed it. They've taken out so many of the features of the old iMovie that there will be people who just feel left out. There's no templates anymore. Much more difficult to modify the audio. You don't have a timeline even anymore. This is kind of a very different look and feel. On the other hand, there's some nice features, the skimming capability that's built into both iPhoto and iLife, the idea of events. It digitizes video quite well. I digitized a couple of old DV tapes. They came in beautifully, easily, worked very well, rewound the tape automatically, imported it. iPhoto has been much improved. I think some very nice new features in iPhoto. It also is faster, which it needed to be. iPhoto was always a little bit of a pig. iTunes you've already played with, probably. I mean, that's been updated. The new GarageBand has some very nice features, including this Magic GarageBand, the ability to easily, quickly make backing tracks. If you're a musician and you're just looking for some backing tracks so you can practice, this is a great solution. I've always been impressed by GarageBand. All in all, I think iLife is a good upgrade. You should be aware of the changes in iMovie. The good news is, if you buy the upgrade, it will retain the old iMovie. And you can still download the old iMovie from Apple's site. I think Apple recognized that there will be some people who, for instance, have purchased plugins that don't work with the new iMovie, will want to stay with the old iMovie. iWork is very impressive. Pages has gotten much better. It's really a full-featured word processor. Numbers is an amazing spreadsheet. Very competitive with Excel, except for the highest-end functions. And it reads and writes Excel, just as Pages reads and writes Microsoft Word very well. I think it's excellent. And, of course, Keynote is easily the best presentation program made. In the past, it's maybe seemed a little feature-like compared to PowerPoint, but now I would say without a doubt it certainly makes the best-looking presentations you've ever seen. And I feel like it's just as capable as PowerPoint. $79 is a great deal for both iLife and iWork, $79 each. And I like this, too. Apple doesn't. There's no encryption. There's a serial number, but there's no activation. And if you feel you're going to install it on more than one machine and you want to be honest, you can pay $99 and get a family license, a family pack of five installs. And I think that's very fair. I, in fact, did do that. I wanted to make sure I could put iLife and iWork on all my machines. So I think Apple's really got a great deal there. And for a home system, I think this is stellar. They've done everything right. It's a very good choice. If you're looking for a home computer that doesn't look ugly, that works well, it's silent, easy to use, very powerful, this is a great choice. So I'd say all around, I'm very happy with the new iMacs. I think Apple did a good job. We're going to take a break. Come back with Steve Gibson, our security guru. We got lots of calls. If you're on the line, hang on. I will get to you, even if we run out of time in the show. I know we only have a half an hour left, but I promise, if you're on the line, I will talk to you, even if it's after the show's over. I'll stay here till we get all the calls done. 8888-ASK. Leo. TechGuyLabs.com is the website. Chatroom, IRC.DSLExtreme.com. And twit.tv for the podcasts. More of your calls to come. Steve Gibson right around the corner. Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy. The Tech Guy is brought to you by DSL Extreme. Call 866-2-GET-NET or visit them online at dslextreme.com. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in Northern California. We're going to get back to your calls in just a second. 8888-ASK-LEO. But we also want right now to take a little time out, as we do every week at this time, to talk to Steve Gibson, our security guru at GRC.com. That's where he sells SpinRite, which... I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy from the beautiful Tech Guy Labs in Northern California. We're going to get back to your calls in just a second. 8888-ASK-LEO. But we also want right now to take a little time out, as we do every week at this time, to talk to Steve Gibson, our security guru at GRC.com. That's where he sells SpinRite, which you've heard me recommend many, many times. It's the best disk recovery and maintenance utility, a must-have for anybody who has a hard drive. And but he also hosts a bunch of free security utilities there, including Shields Up, Leak Test, which we talked about in this week's Security Now podcast. That's another thing we do, a weekly podcast that goes into great depth, an hour-long podcast about security every Thursday at twit.tv. Hi, Steve.
Yo, Leo. Great to be back with you.
You're going to talk about your dongle, although somebody emailed me and said, it's not a dongle, it's a fob.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I'm not sure what the difference is there. But, you know, early on when we first began the show, and including me, we talked about something called multi-factor authentication.
Right, right.
And the idea being that a single factor, for example, is something you know, and other factors...
Which would be like your password, your PIN... Something
exactly.
That only you know, you haven't told anybody. Of course, that's obviously a kind of a weak system if you don't have a very good password. Or you tell your kid, here's the ATM card, go get mommy some cash. there goes your security.
Well, actually, an ATM card is an example of slightly better security, but right, it's not foolproof. Because
but that's something you have.
That's two-factor authentication. Right. It's both something you know, meaning your PIN number, and something you have, meaning, you know, your ATM card. An example of another factor would be something you are. And by that I mean, for example, your retina print, your iris print, your fingerprint, your DNA, you know, that is to say something that is actually who you are. So, for example, or like the size of your hand. When I go to my my ISP's facility at level 3, they want my card, and I put my hand in a scanner, just like, you know, in the James Bond movies, and it measures the physical characteristics of my hand and says, okay, we think this is Steve because, you know, he's got the card, but can we confirm that by agreeing that his hand is the size that we believe it is? So there you get much better security than if it's just like a password that someone could, you know, notice that you'd written down on the underside of your keyboard or on a post-it note or wherever. Well, what's very cool is I've been a long-term user of PayPal for many, many years. And a couple of weeks ago, I just stumbled on something which was at the end of its beta phase and is now out of beta and is available for, I believe it's PayPal users in the United States and Germany and Australia. It's not available in Canada at this point because they're rolling it out in specific marketplaces just sort of to make sure that they've got the bugs out of it and it's working right. But what's cool is, first of all, it's only $5. Whether it's a dongle or a fob, it's $5.
It's something that goes in your keychain. I don't know. It's not a fob nor a dongle.
I don't know. It's an oval
key.
Gizmo.
They call it a security key.
It's a security key, exactly. And what this does is extremely cool. When you first of all, if you have a PayPal account, you go to PayPal. I think it's just you go to PayPal/security key gets you to this, and you're able to request that they charge your PayPal account $5, and they will send you this little oval dongle, fob, whatever you want to call it, that you can carry with you or leave at home or whatever. But the security it provides is that when you press the button on it, it shows, until you turn it off or it turns itself off, a 6-digit number. And that 6-digit number changes every 30 seconds. And it's based on a cryptographic algorithm where they at PayPal Central, and actually this is hosted through another company called VeriSign. They get these things from VeriSign. VeriSign knows what the individual cryptographic ID is for each one of these that they send out. They also know what time of day it is. So from knowing the time of day and the individual cryptographic data, they know what will be displaying on your dongle. I have to call it a dongle.
It dangles. It's a dongle. It dangles.
Exactly. So the idea is that what this does is it prevents you from having your PayPal credentials lost. If you use somebody else's computer, for example, and you might have an occasion to do that, you can't be sure that they don't have a keystroke logger hooked to their keyboard, even if they don't know it. They might have some malware in their machine that is watching what you type and is capturing your logon credentials. And we've talked about this kind of problem before. But what the dongle does is you have to have it with you. In other words, it's two-factor authentication because it combines something you know, meaning your logon credentials, and something you have, meaning this little dongle that you got from PayPal for $5. So when you use PayPal to log on, it says once it's been activated and you've received it and activated it, you log on. If you don't add the 6 digits to the end of your normal password, it'll know that your account has been associated with one of these dongles, and it'll say, what is the current 6 digits showing on your PayPal security key display. So then you push the button, and mine's 166341 right now. Well, it was.
Hey, you just told us your number, dude.
Ah, and that's exactly it. It doesn't matter.
Oh.
That number is valid for 30 seconds.
Oh, so I can tell you my number. It's 170975.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And the point. Oh, now mine's 259187, Leo.
So it changes every 30 seconds.
It changes every 30 seconds. It does not change while you're watching it because you have to push the button in order to request the current one. And their software is tricky enough to say, okay, he's actually giving us the one from 2 seconds ago, but that's fine, you know, because so you don't have to have your clocks exactly synchronized. But what this does, just for $5, and anybody listening who has a PayPal account can ask for this, it really increases the security of your use of PayPal. Now, the comment you made, Leo, when we talked about this during our Security Now podcast is, wait a minute, that means I can never use PayPal again without this. And of course, yes, that's the problem. Security always brings with it some decrease in freedom and flexibility, but that's the price of knowing that nobody can capture your credentials and do anything without your knowledge, as long as you keep control of this little dongle or fob or key ring or whatever we're going
to
call it.
Actually, in this case, to kind of compromise the way PayPal works, if you don't have the dongle, you could still log in, but you have to go through some more hoops. You have to have your secret question and know some more information about yourself. So I'm content with that. It means that I can still use it if I don't have it, but it really would be even harder for somebody to get into my account if they didn't have that.
So now I have 416096, Leo.
Isn't that great?
I love it.
Now, here's the interesting thing. The negative would be that if everybody does this, we're going to have 800 things on our keychain. But the interesting thing is this is a standard, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is part of an emerging standard. There is a, and I believe we've talked about it on the show before, a system called Open ID, which is spreading through the internet, and you'll be able to associate this dongle with other security providers in order so that you don't have to have, well, for example, I guess E-Trade has this and there are a couple of banks that have it and people that say, well, I don't want to have 9 of these and have to sort through them. Well, ultimately, individuals will only need to have one, and they'll be able to register them with the different sites that are aware of this technology in order to authenticate themselves with much greater security on the internet.
That's what I like. I hope that someday I can have something like this in my pocket and it'll allow me to log into all my financial sites, for instance, or my bank, and I don't have to worry about losing money. And at the same time, I have a convenient way to get in there that's secure. Thank you, Steve Gibson. And if you are a PayPal or eBay user and you want to get this key, it's only $5. They subsidize it. I'm sure it costs them more to make them. In fact, when we asked him, he said, yeah, you know, we would give them away, but we found that people don't value something you give away absolutely free. So the way they do this is they give you a $5. You go to paypal.com/security key or ebay.com/security key. You give them $5. And they send you the key almost instantly, and it's a great deal, and I highly recommend it. I use it all the time.
Yep, I do too now.
Thank you, Steve Areno. If you like security and want to know more, make sure you listen to our podcast. Twit.tv is the place to go for all of my netcasts, including Security Now every Thursday with Steve Gibson. And, of course, his site, grc.com, is a great place to browse around for free security software and SpinRite, everybody's favorite utility for protecting and maintaining your drives. Thanks, Stevie.
Bye.
Steve mentioned, somebody asked in the chat room, and I should mention this as well, that it will not protect you against keystroke loggers. Well, I guess it will, come to think of it. Keystroke logger. So let's say somebody gets to you. By the way, it's very hard to protect if somebody gets onto your system physically. But let's say they get a keystroke logger on your system, and it's keeping track of everything you type. Well, your password's changing every 30 seconds. So even though they can record your password, they're only going to get your password and the number that was good for that 30 seconds. It changes. So, in fact, it would protect you against keystroke loggers and so forth. So, to answer the question in the chat room, I think this is a great technology. And clearly we're going to have to improve the way we protect ourselves online. And this is one way to do it. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the number to call. 8888-ASK-LEO. If you'd like to ask some questions, if you're on the line, hang on, because we will get to everybody on the line here. Chat room is live and hopping, too. 385 people in there, 1,000 people watching the video streams. TechGuyLabs.com is the website. More of your calls to come. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Carbonite automatic secure computer backup over the internet. Try it free at carbonite.com. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. That's my number. More of your calls here. Let's get as many as we can in on the show here. Starting with Gary in Sunnyvale, California. Hey, Gary, Leo Laporte.
Yes, hi, Leo. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Just want to tell you, we listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
My wife downloads all your podcasts wherever we're traveling.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
In New Zealand, we were.
I'm so, so sorry.
I have two questions. Hopefully, this is a quick one. I have an HD player, Toshiba.
Okay.
And I have the optical output connected to a an old Yamaha video receiver.
Mm-hmm.
It just decodes Dolby Digital.
Right.
And I was playing regular DVDs, and I could hear sound through my video receiver and the speakers. And I got my first HD DVD, and plug it in, no sound.
Nothing.
Yeah, and the only thing I can see on the box is it says Dolby True HD,
right.
Dolby Digital Plus.
Right. This is what we were talking about, actually, in the first hour of the show. You probably missed it. These are the new form.
I've been on hold for a long time.
Yeah, well, you didn't hear the whole show, I don't think. There are a lot of new formats on these HD DVDs. I don't think that's the issue. The issue, well, it could be that you don't have an appropriate decoder. What you'll need to do is go into the menu on your HD DVD player and select the audio playback that you want. So it's actually in the audio settings, and you'll see many choices. You probably, they're telling, Dargo's telling me in the chat room you want DTS.
Even though my video receiver does not decode DTS, it only does Dolby Digital.
Ah, that might be the problem then. I'm not sure because I haven't faced this myself, but have you gone into the audio version, audio settings of your HD DVD player?
You know, while I've been sitting here on hold, I've been trying to do that, and I'm having a very difficult time getting to, here's settings, and finally I got to it.
Of audio. Course you did, while we're talking.
All it says is button audio.
You don't have it. So you should have a choice of some different kinds of audio. This is what we were talking about with Scott Wilkinson, is the different forms of audio now available. And it will depend on the DVD. So you need to have a DVD in there.
There is. This is the DVD that I was having problems with. It's Phantom of the Opera.
Hmm. And it has to have a DVD. It has to have audio that is compatible with your AV receiver.
If I take the... you know, stereo, red, white cables.
Yeah, you could use that, of
out
course.
Out of the DVD player, yes. And pipe it into the
absolutely.
Video receiver, then I can hear
yep.
it.
Or if you used HDMI, that would also work.
This is an HDMI cable.
Then you
goes from the
then you want to make sure that the audio is being sent not to the optical output, but to the HDMI.
Oh, sorry, the video receiver. This is like a 10-year-old video receiver.
Yeah, I think that's the problem.
HDMI.
I think it's incompatible. I think Dargo's telling me in the chat room that optical. Has to have DTS. That's the only format that'll go out over the optical. If that's the case and your receiver can't handle DTS decoding, then that would explain the problem.
Oh, okay. Now, this is the more difficult question. I'm putting together a new PC for my uncle.
Okay.
And I got a great deal on the Intel CPU and an ECS motherboard at Fry's.
Okay.
And I have a Windows XP... disk from 2002, so it's not even SP2.
Okay.
And when I went to install it, it loads the drivers that it has on the disk, and then it just locks up.
Yeah.
And I also have a XP Professional Second Edition, SP2, with SP2 on it.
Okay.
That loads fine. So I'm assuming it's a driver problem.
I would guess you're absolutely right.
And there's a place where you press F6.
Right, to add additional drivers.
You have a floppy.
Yeah.
So I went and added a floppy to this little system.
Just so to do this.
And, but I can't, the motherboard company doesn't provide you with the files that go on the floppy.
And you can't go online and find them.
I tried. It's a, it, you know, whatever the...
ECS is not the top of the line, let me put it that way.
I know, but it was like the motherboard was free.
Yeah, that's why. And but you got what you paid for. You know that you. It sounds like you do need the motherboard drivers if you want to continue with this XP install.
But they don't provide them on the floppy. And I mean, I've noticed that other companies like Abit and Asus and Gigabyte or whatever. They all have these type of micro ATX boards that have this G33 and an ICH9 chip on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to, you know, I'm going to.
You can't use somebody else's drivers. You've got to use their ECS drivers.
Even though it's the same Intel chipset?
Well, yeah, but I mean, you might be. You might strike gold and be lucky. But you're pretty much want. Are you telling me that nowhere on the site or anywhere the ECS will provide their motherboard drivers?
I sent them a support email, and I haven't heard diddly squat.
That's
back
terrible.
From
them. I think frankly you need the motherboard drivers. I mean that's bottom line. If Windows XP won't boot, it's interesting that SP2 does work with it. Clearly, Microsoft came along and found some drivers that worked. Don't know exactly what to tell you. I think that you've got to find those drivers. You might be able to get compatible drivers from another manufacturer, but usually that does not work. I'm not sure what to say. This is the problem with a cheap motherboard. Hey, if you're on the line, thank you. I appreciate it, Gary. Sorry I haven't been of much help. Roger and Michael and Kate and David, don't go anywhere. We're going to get to your calls in just a little bit. I'll put a link in the show notes to the best driver information I can from ECS. Looks like they do have some drivers, so we'll put them in the show notes. CNY Mike has found them in the chat room, and we'll put those in the show notes. So maybe you want to go to the show notes, Gary, techguylabs.com. I'll be back right here on this very same station next week or tomorrow if you're lucky, and I hope you'll join me then. Meanwhile, have a great Geek Week. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy. Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to hear the show live, check your local listings or visit our website, leo.am, for a list of stations where you can hear the Tech Guy radio show live on the air. You can also hear archived shows at leo.am and subscribe to our podcast there, or open your podcasting client and subscribe to the feed at leo.am/podcasts/KFI. Thanks to Howard Bailey for the music for this podcast. You can find more of Howard's work at soundclick.com. Thanks to Premier Radio Networks for syndicating the show. Most of all, thanks to you for listening. This is Leo Laporte. I'll see you next time on The Tech Guy.